Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 52.
Bhavan. That's Hindi. This week we saw the ever-present and lovely Bindlestiff Variety Open Night Circus Show. I never know exactly what it's called, but just like the Bindlestiff Open Variety Night.
Exactly. At Dixon Place.
At Dixon Place. And we went with Mr. and Mrs. G, our friends who do Crossbow. And it's such a fun night because everyone's encouraged to try something that they've never done before or like an act that they haven't really perfected. So you just like never know what you're going to get.
And it was pretty crazy. I mean, the front row had Huffy Burgess, Michael Bongar, and Paul Binder all sitting next to one another. So it's a pretty intimidating lineup. I know there's some name drops that if you weren't a regular listener, you might not catch. But those are all some heavy hitters from the circus all sitting front row. It was cool. I mean, just some good acts, really good handstand act.
Yeah, really good handstand act. I think the clowning acts were interesting. Because I guess you don't know if you have a good clown act until you try it and it bombs. So I guess like in that way, it really was helpful for them.
Yes.
Because I wouldn't say they went well.
But I think that's the point of the open variety night is for people to experiment and try and see what works. And
yeah,
like I said to people who asked me about if I should go, the answer is yes. And you'll probably see two things that blow your mind in a good way and two things that blow your mind in a not so good way.
In a weird way.
In a weird way.
But it's fun because it's such a nice like community of New York circus people that it's nice to see every month.
It really is. I think it's a first or second Monday of every month.
So it's a first Monday of every month.
First Monday. Go on bindlestiff.org, the website. Check it out. Go see the show. You'll probably see us there.
Yes. In some interesting news, not sad news because luckily no one was hurt, but the Knie tent blew over.
So Circus Knie is probably the biggest circus in Switzerland, traditional classical circus. They tour in this beautiful big top tent. It's seats probably about 2,000 people. And on Facebook, maybe yesterday or days ago, people started posting videos of them taking their tent down in a really terrible storm. And at first, you sort of see the canvas all sort of waving in the wind and like whipping back and forth. And then the guy drops his camera a little bit and goes in German, like, oh, my God. And then tits it back up and you see the entire tent just collapse. I've never really seen a video like that before, no. To be totally honest. The king poles sort of fell inwards. Thankfully, nobody was hurt. Everybody's okay. It didn't even actually affect the touring schedule because they were tearing the tent down that night anyways.
Yeah.
But still kind of a scary thing to happen. Happened in Ticino, Italy.
I guess it seems like that tent is totally destroyed. The king poles are bent, so you can't use the tent anymore. But they were able to, like, that night buy a replacement tent, which is pretty incredible.
And sorry, by Ticino, Italy, I mean Ticino, Switzerland.
Right. I was like, wait, it happened in Switzerland.
It did. It's on the Italian border.
Yeah, so close enough.
Close enough. It's a pretty crazy video. If you're on Facebook, check it out. We're sending our best wishes to the team over at Knie. Get back on your feet. Glad everybody is okay. That it's just damage to equipment and nothing worse.
Yes. So as we talked about last podcast, we went to see Big Apple Circus and Mark Lonergan, the director of this year's show, was on our podcast.
The last episode.
So since then, the New York Times review has come out and
Critics pick,
but the actual review is kind of strange. And it's been like a conversation in the comments. Basically, this reviewer doesn't know a thing about circus. And that's the problem with it. Like, most critics who review theater have seen theater.
Or movies know about movies.
But the people who are reviewing circus know nothing about it. She compares, you know, Roller Bola to a panda trying to snowboard. And Elaine Kramer's amazing contortion act. She says that, you know, Elaine does a trick in her act with that. She just holds her entire body up by her teeth. And she's like, you know, every dentist in the audience is white knuckling and kind of all these like stupid, witty ish remarks about almost every act. And it seems like it's really taking the piss out of everyone's skill and level. And we're like, she's not actually talking about the quality of the show. She's just making, you know, quote unquote, funny remarks about each act and not like the actual skill or quality or like the training hours of each act. like literally after every single paragraph, she ends it with like a funny remark about that act and funny to her, you know. I just think it's a little disrespectful to send a New York Times critic who, like, you know, the New York Times is regarded as one of the highest voices, and but send someone who just clearly knows nothing about the art form.
But, you know, this goes Trav SD, another previous guest who's also a critic and a journalist and a circus and theater maker himself, posted on Facebook talking about, are written reviews relevant anymore? Like, is anybody even reading that New York Times review? And I think it's actually a pretty good segue into something I want to talk about in the podcast today, which is a presentation done by Jim Coulter, who is a co-founder of TPG. TPG is one of the two groups that bought Cirque du Soleil a couple of years ago. And he talked about at Bloomberg's Year Ahead Summit in New York on November 8th, this concept of why they are investing in experiences. And it'll give me a second to tie it back to the review, but I'll ultimately tie it back to the review. So he talks about why do they invest in Cirque du Soleil? Why do they invest in Airbnb? And to me, this was like one of the most interesting sort of ways of thinking about growth in the circus industry that I've heard yet without being specifically about the circus industry. So he points out that 78% of millennials would choose to spend money on a desirable experience or event over buying something desirable. So say it's like you'd rather like go be the guy at Coachella or the girl who is eating at a cool food stand in Smorgasburg than necessarily buying a sweater that might cost the same as a ticket to Coachella or a fancy hamburger or something. And there are three main reasons, or actors, he calls it, that he thinks are driving growth in the sector of live experiences and events. And the first one is that it's easier to buy. And the idea is that probably everybody always wanted to buy stuff, experiences, and go and do things, but it previously used to be easier just to go to a store and buy a thing. And now people can do pre-shopping, digital pre-shopping, which is where I tie this back into reviews. And that if you want to go and see Big Apple Circus, you might look at the New York Times review, but you're also just as likely to look at the TripAdvisor review or the Yelp review, particularly if you're a tourist, because there's these tourist-driven websites. People can more comfortably spend money on these really expensive tickets. You know, the Big Apple tickets go up to $140 this year, knowing that they've read lots and lots of reviews. People more similar to them than necessarily a New York Times critic who doesn't like circus to start with. The other two reasons are that it's easier to share, basically that going to live experiences and being able to take photos of them and post about them on social media adds value to something the way that buying an object doesn't, and that's somehow psychologically demonstrable, so that if you can say, look, I've been here and I've done this and everybody recognizes it, that makes you feel better then. If you just own something, apparently. And the third reason is self-branding. And the idea, going back to the buying a sweater, you used to buy your J. Crew sweater or your Ralph Lauren polo to sort of say, like, this is who I am, this is my brand, this is what I look like. And now people are doing that by taking photos of themselves and selfies at events and saying, I'm the guy who went to Big Apple. And for all these reasons, it's why they're investing in Cirque du Soleil, obviously, because Cirque du Soleil makes experiences, and they think people will continue to spend on experiences and drive that growth. But as it relates to circus in general, I think it's just a pretty good sign that people would rather buy a ticket to something than buy an item or a thing. And if we can just figure out a way to make more circus shows and more shows in general interesting, worthwhile experiences that people can self-brand themselves at, then I think we'll continue to see people coming and, like good old Jim says, growth in the sector.
On today's podcast, we have Shana Kennedy, who started Circadium, a new circus conservatory program in Philadelphia. Shana started as a performer and also just like a normal academic. Her story is really interesting because she doesn't take the normal circus route and kind of from early on knew that she wanted to be a teacher and not just a performer. Hearing her talk about the new school and the program makes me want to go back to school and study circus. Josh and I were lucky enough to take a day trip to Philadelphia and see the new circus school, which is located in a church, and see the first class of circus performers. They were in their theater class, theater movement class, maybe. And then we saw them in aerials. The campus is absolutely beautiful. And I highly recommend anyone who's looking at circus schools to at least go visit Circadium and see what it has to offer.
But before we let you listen to the podcast, go on Facebook, like us, Twitter, tweet us, subscribe to our email list, subscribe to us on iTunes, give us a good review. We really appreciate it. And follow us on Instagram. We always post fun things. Lindsay's really good at the story.
And here is our podcast interview with Shayna.
Where are you from originally? Where did you grow up?
I grew up just outside of Boston.
Oh, where?
I was in Natick, Massachusetts.
I'm from Medfield.
Whoa, we were neighbors at some point. But I left there when I was 18. So okay. Probably when you were still very small. And I went to college in Washington, D.C. But I jumped out of college at Midway to go to circus school. So at that point, I started spending more time in Europe.
But were you seeing like circus shows coming like through Natick or the Boston area when you were a kid? Were you into it then?
Well, the big one, I'm not sure if it was still there when you were there, but it was the Clyde Beatty Cole Brothers Circus.
Oh, yeah. That I have a photo of me in front of it.
That was a big deal when I was growing up. So every July 4th, Clyde Beatty Cole Brothers would come to my town and they would do the whole setup with the elephants and the tents and the clowns and the cannons and everything.
That was in Natick?
It was in Natick.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Every July 4th. I mean, it probably went to all the towns around there, but Natick was sort of the big festive weekend thing. And I was hooked every year. So every year I would go and I'd come home from the circus and I'd be like, I'm going to be an aerialist. And I'd like hang up rings for my swing set and play around for a few weeks until I figured out I couldn't do anything and drift off. And the next year I'd go and be like, I'm going to be a clown. And just every year as a kid. But there was no obvious way to do any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. This was like 1980s, early 90s in Massachusetts. And there was no clear path for anything like that. So when I was about 15, I started getting a little more determined. And I went through the want ads, those are some of their want ads, and found an old unicycle that was listed in the want ads. And I made my parents drive me all over the state trying to find this unicycle. Got myself a unicycle and was determined to like teach myself to ride. I was going to do circus, determined. And it was really hard, partly because the unicycle I got was too small for me, which I didn't realize at the time. I didn't have a teacher. So I just would like try and fall and try and fall and try and fall. And also at that time in my life, I didn't understand what it meant to learn a physical skill. I was not an athlete, so I hadn't learned the process of practicing and failing and trying again and spending a lot of time on things. I always tell this story of how I learned to juggle around like later that year. I picked up one of those penguin juggle bug catalogs and had the learn to juggle experience. And it was so hard for me to focus on juggling that I would log how much time I practiced each day. So I made this little notebook. And if you look back at the notebook, it says things like practice juggling. 5 minutes. Oh. Next day, I was like, practically 7 minutes, you know? And I was so proud of myself because I was like, right. I did it. 7 whole minutes. I worked on this thing. And to me, that was like a huge accomplishment. So it took me forever to learn to juggle. And that was like 15, 16, you know, by the time I finally got the hang of juggling, I found the MIT Juggling Club in Boston and started going there. And that was when the world sort of opened up a little bit to me about like, there's other jugglers and people that do this. And I started thinking a little bit bigger.
When you went to college, before going to circus school, what were you studying?
I started off as an international relations major and switched to French language after coming back from a break.
Practical for circus.
It is now. Yeah. It at the time, I've always been really interested in international culture and I thought IR was the way to go. And it turns out that IR is a lot of like economics and that was terrible for me. So what I loved was the language and the culture and the people. Mm-hmm. So switching to a language major really made sense. And now I use my French all the time.
So you clearly loved circus when you were little. But then what was it that made you say, I have to go to just a normal college?
Well, I was a National Merit Scholar. And so I had gotten pretty much a free ride to the George Washington University.
Oh, wow.
And it was a tough choice because there also wasn't any clear path to go to circus school either. So it was like, I guess I'll just go to college because that's what people do. But then about a couple months into my first freshman year, I was having one of those freshman meltdowns where I was just like, I don't want to be doing this. I ended up researching and finding circus schools in Europe and told my parents I want to take a leave of absence. So I did leave.
Were they supportive when you said that?
My parents are really supportive. They were nervous, but they also could see like this was what I really wanted to do. And I was just miserable. So they said, okay. And they actually agreed to pay some of my way because with the National Merit Scholarship and also all these advanced placement courses I'd taken, I actually had enough college credits to do a bachelor's degree in 3 years. Oh. So I could take a full year off, come back,
do 2 more years,
still graduate in 4 years. And so they were saying, well, we'll take that little bit of money we have set aside for that extra year and give that to you to go to circus school overseas. So I applied for Circumedia.
It's in Bristol, right?
It's in Bristol, yeah.
In the UK.
In the UK. It's so funny to think about that time of life because there was no internet. So I don't even know how I found this. I think I found the schools through Cascade Juggling Magazine. I'm pretty sure that's the only place I had information about circus schools. Mm-hmm. You couldn't research it anywhere. So found Circumedia, applied, got in, and left and was part of the United
5 Would you apply the particular skill?
Juggling. And I wasn't a tremendous juggler. I was just a very so-so juggler at the time, but they were very new school at that time, and they were willing to take, and this show is coming from America. They thought that was exciting.
Right.
So they were like, okay, let's do it. So I jumped into their second ever full-time course.
Oh, wow.
At Circuit Media in 1995. I did that just for 1 year, but it was a life-changing year.
Is that building also a church where they train?
It is now.
It is now. What was it now? What was it then?
Back then it was like a campus out in the suburbs. And they were kind of like here, they were renovating different spaces, but St. Paul's church where they are now, they actually have both campuses open now. And the newer spaces is inside a church.
Mm.
So I still go back there a lot. And the director of Circuit Media is one of my mentors. His name's Bim Mason and he's a brilliant man. So I taught him a lot as we were growing our own school.
So you're off in the UK, your year ends. Are you like, do you feel like you want to come back or are you going to stay in Europe?
Well, so I'd gotten a certificate from this 1 year program that they had there. And even though I had a lot of friends and ties in Europe, I had to come back and finish my degree. It was like, you either come back and finish it or you don't. And with a free ride, it was like, you better just do it. So I came back and I finished college. And during college, those years of college, I started just freelancing, you know, freelance performing, juggling, stilt walking, trapeze, tightrope, anything I could set up. I was doing it. I learned aerials by that time at circus school. So I was performing as a freelance aerialist as well. And by the time I graduated college, I had enough of a smattering of a career to start traveling with different shows, performing a variety of things. So it was
good. Were your friends in college like, wait, where did you go for a year? Where were you?
Yeah, yeah. It was definitely a weird path at the time. It seemed very weird at the time. But that I think I thrived off of that, of being kind of the strange one at my college campus.
Yeah.
And the juggling community, honestly, was what provided me with a strong network, because my husband, Greg, was also kind of a superstar in the juggling community. And so we were traveling to festivals a lot. He was doing shows all over the place. And so we just had a lot of friends everywhere that were part of this. We met at the Philadelphia Juggling Convention in 1994. So it was just before I left for circus school.
Oh, wow. You guys have known each other.
Was he juggling before back then too?
He was juggling. He was at that time, he was an engineer who was juggling part-time. I told you a little bit about that. Yeah. So yeah, he had an engineering job and he was just doing part-time juggling, but he was still like ridiculously good at juggling. And Greg was like headlining all the shows and this and that. So it was a fun time of life, but he was still working. And so I went over to circus school for a year. We kind of kept in touch during that year. And by the time I came back, he was competing at the IGA with his hemisphere routine, the balls in a bowl.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just kind of making a name for himself as a juggler at that time. And I was tagging along a little bit and doing my own thing. And then what happened after that? We started touring with a little company called Luma. Luma's a glow in the dark show. And if you've seen it, it's a show that does mostly corporate events now, but back in those days they were trying to do a lot of theater tours.
Oh, cool.
And so we did that for, I went to some real amazing places, all over the
world.
And
it's a glow in the dark show. Cause we actually interviewed a girl in Australia who produced a glow in the dark show.
Yeah.
So is it when you Luma, is it just totally black and you just see the performers with glow in the dark paint?
Well, and this is one of the things that I think was going against Luma. You didn't even see the people. You saw just the objects.
Oh.
Right? So they would make all these shapes and interesting things with light and cool stuff, like really cool shapes, but you never saw the performers all in black and you don't see them. Yes. That's still kind of Luma's signature thing. When I was involved in it, we did a little bit of experimenting putting aerialists in glow-in-the-dark costumes. So I would do a Spanish web act in a glow-in-the-dark costume. But that was the extent of it. And it was before the time where they had all the crazy LED technology with moving lights on costumes and things. Now I think they're doing a little more of that.
Mm-hmm.
But back then it was like a black light show, basically. Oh. Yeah. But we went to some amazing places. Some of my most memorable performing experiences were with that company.
Oh, cool.
We were in India and Rotterdam and Venezuela and Edinburgh and just all kinds of amazing places.
But somehow you kept getting pulled back to Philadelphia.
Yeah, we did. So in the year 2000, Greg and I bought a house in Philadelphia and decided to kind of put down some roots. Yeah, exactly. And I started teaching classes, just people that had heard about me, teaching basic static trapeze classes and aerial rope classes out of the house. Greg, in case you haven't noticed from this building, is a real handyman type of person.
I was like, everyone needs a Greg.
Oh, yes. He builds things. He fixes things. It's been a great opportunity for us as a circus community to have someone who's so hands-on. And so he did the same thing in our house. He knocked out floors and walls so we had more space to practice and teach classes. And then he built our first outdoor rig so we could teach classes in the backyard.
Was that Airplay? Was the name of that?
That was Airplay. It was the very first company that I started back in like 2000. And everyone, you know, everyone who's around that time talks about the days of, oh, remembered classes in the backyard. They forget all like the bugs and the, right. you know, the not so fun parts about being in the backyard.
Did you enjoy teaching when you were making that transition? Was it like fun and challenging? Yeah.
I've always enjoyed teaching.
What do you like about it?
Something about teaching puts me really deeply in the moment. And I'm sure you guys know this from also performing experiences is that, there's sometimes where you feel so like alive and you're not thinking about anything else. You're completely in that moment. Mm-hmm. And teaching does that for me more so than performing. Actually. I found that in those early years when I was still trying to be a performer, I was having a harder time. It was not the best fit for me. I don't love the crazy ups and downs of show business. I'm much more of a steady person that likes to do a little bit of work each day and a little bit of rest each day.
Yeah.
Whereas for Greg, it's a perfect fit because he just goes all out and then crashes all out and crashes. But for me, teaching was a much better fit for my personality. And I also really love that process of sparking something in another person and having them have those moments of success. Mm. I think you see it in at least a lot of the teachers I have here, that the ones who are just really naturally teachers, they get a genuine joy out of someone else's success. And it's something that you can't teach too well. Is, you know, can you really love teaching? But I definitely love teaching. I miss it. I don't teach so much anymore. And I do miss it. Yeah.
So was there a natural like group of people from Philadelphia who were coming to take classes, or did you have to like educate the community here that it existed?
It's so funny to think back then, because this was, it was almost 20 years ago now. And at that time, like aerial classes weren't a common thing at all. And so the people that heard about me, mostly was word of mouth. I put a couple of ads in like the local city paper for, you know, trapeze classes. And we just had a handful of students. They were mostly the kind of students that wanted fitness. There were adults who wanted fitness, but in some kind of, you know, edgy new way, something different than the gym, right? Now that's different because there's so many things that do that. So many boutique fitness studios of all kinds that I think just being kind of a quirky person teaching trapeze in your backyard is not enough to make a sustainable business model. But at that time, it was very workable and very, very different. So I built my practice really slowly. I was also having kids during those years. So I have three children now.
How old are they?
They're now 14, 13, and 10.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I was having babies and teaching every time I wasn't busy with babies. And it worked. It really worked. And we started to grow just very gradually in those first few years till about 2005 or six, when we started kind of looking for bigger spaces to move to. We were starting to outgrow the house and babies needed to live in rooms in the house. So we had to find space for them and start taking the next steps. Yeah.
Are your kids into circus?
They are. So my youngest is particularly into circus right now. She's part of our youth troupe. And if you ask her what her favorite circus thing is, she'll just say everything. She likes everything circus. She's 10. My older two have done plenty of circus over the years, but they're kind of drifting off to other interests now.
So did AirPlay morph into a new company when you moved to your new space, or did it stay the same?
It did. So AirPlay was an LLC that moved, that changed into the Philadelphia School of Circus Arts in 2008. So that was when we opened our first big space on Green and Rittenhouse Streets. And that was kind of similar to the size of our sanctuary right now, just one big space, not quite as high ceilings. It was about 20-foot ceilings. And we were there for almost 10 years.
And was that a nonprofit as well? Or did you like, how did you structure that?
That became and still is actually now an S Corp that's taxed as an LLC. Mm. So it's a business model and it works as kind of a fee for service business where we don't fundraise for it. We pretty much charge money for the classes and those classes pay for our teachers and our insurance and our overhead. Everything like that. It's a very straightforward model. And it's the one that I was most used to and comfortable with. So that switching to a nonprofit model has actually been a challenge to learn about in the last few years.
Do you like the aspects of running a circus business, you know, the operations and the financial challenges, or is that like not fun?
I would definitely not call it fun. It's not the most fun part of what I do, but it's really necessary. And so there's everything from financial management to strategic planning and keeping on top of things, organizational stuff that it's not truly enjoyable, but I feel like I can do it and I can be good at it. And there's a lot of pride that comes from being good at it and from being able to manage things that other people appreciate. So, you know, I do kind of, as the school gets bigger and the most fun parts I have right now are the times that I get back in teaching the classroom. I'm teaching history of circus right now.
Oh, great. So that's where like, do you start though with thing. That? You're talking like the Greeks, or are you starting with like Philip Astley?
We started with, the medieval time. We started in like ancient Egypt, went all the way back there and then worked our way up. We've just gotten to French contemporary circus, which is super fun, super fun. so that's one of my highlights of my week. But also as the school gets bigger, there's so many interesting partnerships that happen, and helping to spearhead artistic work that is definitely the more fun parts of the job. Mm. But when I started the school, especially starting as a simple sole proprietorship, I had to learn a lot of business functions that I think have served me well over the years. I went to business planning class. I wrote a full business plan. I learned how to use QuickBooks. You know, I've had to do things that didn't come naturally, but now I couldn't live without them, you know? So yeah, I think circus in general is a bit lacking in people who can manage businesses. Mm-hmm. And so I'm happy that I can do that. Mm-hmm. And hopefully there'll be other people that can, do the same thing, because there's so many great organizations out there, and if you can't balance a checkbook, like, there's only so far that the organization could go.
Mm-hmm. So at what point did the idea of Circadium come about?
So this is a good story. So in 2013, I was in New York for something or some conference or other, and I was hanging out with Duncan Wall. Mm-hmm. And we went out to coffee, and we were talking about what's next for circus in America, and circus education in America particularly. And, you know, at that time he was still very immersed in The Ordinary Acrobat and his passion projects. And so I was saying, well, you know, at some point there will be a true higher education program for circus in the States. And he looked at me and he said, well, what are you waiting for? And I was like, oh, right.
I have to do it.
No one's going to just do that, are they? You know? And it just suddenly dawned on me in that moment that there was no one else who was more prepared or more able to do something like that than I was. I think I had been up to that point assuming that the other circus schools that are doing ProTrack programs would just keep going on that path. And they are still on that path, mm-hmm. I think. But the need to kind of not do really a grassroots, let's start small and grow bigger, but actually just make a big gesture and say, let's just do this in a big mm-hmm. way, I think was a need. Mm-hmm. And I felt a little nervous about it, but I also felt like, yeah, I think I should just try this, just try to do it. So that was 2013. And in that year, that same year, we had a big meeting with a bunch of people who were all interested in the issue. People from all over the country sort of came together in a little focus group of sorts for a day and discussed what would that look like? What would a higher education circus school look like? And we threw out some sort of basic parameters of it. But then later that year, that was when the Circus Conservatory also announced its plans. It was probably like fall. So we actually incorporated Circadium as a nonprofit called the Institute of American Contemporary Circus in 2013. We were like, it's got to be grandiose sounding. It's got to be American sounding. It's got to be big. And then when they announced the Circus Conservatory, I just felt like the air was just deflated out of my whole vision. I was like, oh, they're going to do it. And they seem like they've got a really good plan. And what am I even doing? And so I had to go through a lot of sort of self-questioning of, should we be doing this? Mm-hmm. And if so, and if we're doing it as well as they're doing it, or if we're both going to do it, then how do I distinguish what we're doing? Mm-hmm. It was actually really good for our program in the end, because I dug down into kind of what makes Philadelphia unique, what makes us, the teaching staff that we have here, unique. And I came up with the idea that our connections to the European model, and particularly the physical theater component of circus training, and being based in a really lovely urban environment, are important characteristics of what we have to offer here. Mm-hmm. So I decided to rename the school Circadium, because it felt to me like a name that was cooler, that sounded more natural to what I was trying to do. The Institute of American Contemporary Circus just wasn't what it was really. It's too formal and too fussy sounding. And we are based in more of a playful mode here. Mm-hmm. So that's that. We took off on that. So starting in 2014, we were just known as Circadium. We formed the board of directors and we just kind of kept going on our path. And then when Circus Conservatory kind of collapsed, I don't know when that was, 2015, 2016.
Yeah.
Probably whatever that was. All of a sudden it's like, okay, so I guess we're now the only ones doing this.
Yeah. Right.
From being on deck to, you know,
right. So now we are really trailblazing. Yeah. The one thing that was really gratifying for me about that process was that while Circus Conservatory was doing their kind of their rollout of their plan, everything sounded so great and perfect and all done and taken care of. And I kept going, why is this is not working for me. Like, it is not just happening. Like, how are they figuring this all out? Like, what magic pills do they know over there to make this work? And when it did fall apart, I was like, oh, right. No, it actually is really hard. I'm not doing something wrong. Like, it just reinforced to me that there was no magic to make it happen. It's just a lot of work. Josh reminds me of
that. I really connect with you when you say that, because I always say, I'm like, how are they just doing this? Like, how is this show just happening? And then, you know, stuff comes out and we hear like all the mess behind it. And I think there's like a really, especially today, this thing of social media and all this stuff where it feels perfect, right? And everyone's achieving exactly what they want.
Right.
And you don't get to hear the struggle and all the problems that go through it.
Right.
And, you know, you constantly have to remind yourself, like, they're probably having the same problems.
Yes, you know? Exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, and then, so now you guys are in this beautiful church.
Before you get to the church, when you were thinking about like what kind of thing you wanted the school to teach, what were like important qualities? Like, what's the kind of student that you wanted to take? And then also, like, what's the kind of graduate you wanted to have?
Sure. I thought a lot about that and a lot about the other schools that exist too, and what they're, what kind of students they are bringing in and sending out. I look a lot at the European schools, and the European schools have this wonderful polyvalence concept, a lot like the, a lot like ENC, where they really emphasize dance and theater alongside circus training. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes a long way in creating, you know, today's contemporary circus artists. So bringing in multidisciplines was very important from the beginning. But the other thing that I felt was kind of unique to our program is an idea that's more grounded in my history and Greg's, which is the idea of entrepreneurship, that students who leave a circus school have got to be able to find a work path for themselves.
Particularly in America.
Particularly in America. Exactly. It's just not like Europe where they could just walk out into the world and have options waiting for them. Or even like ENC, where most of them leave with contracts.
Or apply for grant funding.
Right. Although we'd like to help our students if they wanted to go that path, it's not going to be a path for all of them. Yeah. And we also really believe that what we want from our students is not 7-minute artists that go and audition for things, but artists that want to start their own companies. Because we all know in America that circus companies, there is a shortage of them. There's a shortage of new, edgy, young circus companies. And there are some starting, and we're very excited to support those that are growing up, but there's still very few compared to the rest of the world. And for a healthy sector, we need to have lots of those young companies starting. So our real goal is to get our students on that path to making their own work and making their own companies.
So as far as though the identity in training students, do you feel like, you know, when you see people graduate out of ENC, you know, it's very, everybody knows that school, so it's a good example. Often they all feel very similar to one another in what is coming out and what are the values as far as like the kinds of techniques and the kinds of performance. Do you feel like Circadium is going to have or does have an identity like that? Or, and if you do, like, what is that kind of identity? Sure.
I feel like that's a very big open question right now. A lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of a school's identity is going to be shaped by the staff that is here and what the stamps that they put on their work and the types of students that are coming to with them. I have heard people say that there's this Quebec model and they all kind of look the same. Personally, I see a lot of diversity when I see the shows coming and the artists coming out of Quebec, but I understand that they are trained in a very similar way.
I would say that the Quebec school is different from ENC.
Yeah.
Granted, French Canadian circus does have a style, generally speaking.
Sure.
But
yeah.
It's also, we were in Australia recently, and the NICA graduates also sort of feel like they have a style. And I don't think it's a bad thing.
No.
I'm just wondering if any particular values that you have from your life that you're like, I want to make sure past entrepreneurship these kids get or understand.
Well, in fact, especially as far as aesthetics, there isn't. And because I think that what American circus artists have to bring to the table is going to be very unique. And I don't feel I know what that is yet. Mm-hmm. I'm really waiting to see what the students bring. A lot of it comes from our history, from American history and what circus has been up till now. Mm-hmm. So much based in like showmanship and tradition and entrepreneurship. And these things are really deeply rooted in our culture. And then bringing in a lot of our teaching staff has theater backgrounds. So bring all these teachers in to work with these artists. I think it's really a question of what they're going to look like and what is going to come out from here.
The exciting part of it.
It's really exciting.
I mean, it's exciting to me because Josh and I, you know, in our show that we did and that we're the shows that we're producing now, we like always look for the people who can dance.
True.
And like be a character and act. And so when you're saying they're taking dance classes and theater, you know, that's definitely something that not very many circus artists who come from, you know, different genres of schools always have, you know, they have their act and they're so good at their act. But then if you ask them to do like a dance or like play a character. It's a lot more foreign to them.
Sure.
You know, and a few of them can really do it, but
yeah. Well, it's fascinating also if you talk to the directors of other schools, because like in Montreal, for example, they'll say that they are seeing many more American circus artists coming through who are ridiculously talented in one thing. Mm-hmm. Like they're just unbelievable in one discipline. Mm-hmm. And they don't always get into ENC because ENC is not looking for people that can just do this amazing right. one skill. They need like diverse skill sets before they even start. Mm-hmm. And then you talk to, you know, people overseas who worry that their students are not, maybe they're deeply artistic and creative and they're making amazing work, but they don't actually know how to take that work anywhere else and get work with it. Like yeah. they can't right. bring it outside because it's so specific esoteric or specific. Yeah. yeah. So, yeah. So I love hearing those stories to figure out what, where we're going to finish that picture. Mm-hmm. And I can see in our first class, we definitely have a first class of students who are very technical in their base, and they know that what they need is training and everything else. But until they commit themselves to a 3-year full-time program, they're not really going to get that. Mm-hmm. We have a student here who I was watching for years, and she knew she should take some dance, she should take some theater, but you really have to kind of be in a place where it's required yeah. to yes. make it a priority.
Particularly if your thing is like, I love doing aerials or I love juggling. Like it's exactly. hard to force yourself to go do something that you don't, right. you're uncomfortable
exactly.
doing.
Exactly. And I have to say, one of the things I'm most pleased about in the first few months of our course is that when you talk to the students about how they like their classes, they almost all see their favorite classes dance.
Oh, really?
They're loving the dance class.
What kind of dance styles are you teaching?
So we teach a combination of modern and ballet. There's mm-hmm. one day a week that's just ballet. Mm-hmm. And then a couple days a week of modern, they do some improv. They're starting contact improv this week. And I mean, they'll dabble in lots of things over yeah. 3 years. But our teacher is wonderful. And the students are really just enjoying it tremendously.
Well, that's a good segue to talk about the curriculum a little bit. What is like a day in the life of a student here?
Sure. So we have an interesting weekly structure where they're here for very long days on Monday and Tuesday, Thursday and Friday. And Wednesday is kind of an open day where they can come and train if they want. They have one class on that day, what's called Fundamentals of Movement. And that's based in like Feldenkrais and Bartnieff and all these bodywork mm-hmm. styles. But mostly that day is open and it's a gentler day for them. But on the other 4 days, they are here from 8 o'clock in the morning till 5:30 with just packed schedules of, begins with a 45-minute warm up each day. Then they go to circus rotations during the morning, have a lunch break, and then they go into academics and dance and theater classes in the afternoon. So it's busy. Their academics are, in the first year, they have 3 academic classes. So they're just once, each class is once a week for 90 minutes. They have history, writing, and music are the 3 academics in the first year. And each year that will change, and they have some electives mm-hmm. as the years go on as well.
For the music class, yeah. what do you teach? Is it an instrument, or is it reading music? Is it like...
It's a bit of both. The students who've come in have a mix of musical backgrounds. Some of them are starting from zero and some of them have play instruments and can sing and have a lot of experience. So the teacher's doing some combinations of things. She's having them read music. She's having them do some, lately it's a lot of body percussion. I'm doing a lot of body percussion. Mm-hmm. But we're not in the first year really trying to transition them. So in second and third year, they'll be transitioning music and dance and theater work into their circus disciplines. Mm-hmm. But this year, it's much more like we're just learning the nuts and bolts. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. We're finding out what we can do with music and different musical styles.
Cool. So I'm wondering mm-hmm. if you can tell people who are listening a little bit about the building that we are sitting in sure. and how this came about.
I'd love to. We're very proud of this building. We're sitting inside what was the St. Madeleine Sophie Church, which was built in 1925. And it was a Catholic church. It was a beautifully well-maintained church up until the diocese consolidated a bunch of churches last year. And so this became up for sale. We had looked at a bunch of churches, actually. This was not our first one that we looked at, but this was by far the dreamiest mm-hmm. and the best. And we weren't sure we were going to be able to afford to buy it because it was combined with this beautiful house up on the hill, which is the rectory where the priests live. And between that whole property was too expensive for us. But we have a wonderful friend, Dave Gillies, who's from the Give and Take Jugglers, and he was interested in buying that house. So we were able to subdivide the property so that Dave could buy the house and we could buy the church and live as this little circus commune up here.
It's really magical.
Yeah.
Like just the trees and like all the rooms and the stone. And yeah. just really, really nice.
It really feels like a campus.
It does.
And that's something we're just so excited about. I mean, it's also very overwhelming. We're so new here and there's, you know, we haven't gotten our first heating bills yet and that's kind of terrifying.
So it's been like 2 months, right?
It's been 2 months. Yeah. Yeah. We renovated it in whirlwind. We spent a lot of, yes, the first 3 months were, because there was, we had a little overlap in the summer. We would renovate some parts of the building in August and we moved in September and it's been very intense. But yeah, I think we are all really happy and we're all really happy feeling like this is our permanent home that we're going to be in forever.
Although the sanctuary, is that what it's called? Is amazing. Like all the rigging points and you have like just walking into a room and seeing like trapeze and silk and rope and what was the other?
And eventually a tramp wall.
We have Lyra. Yeah, we're going to have a tramp wall in there soon. And yeah, and if you'll be able to see these pictures online of the sanctuary space. It's a very pretty space with, I think it peaks out about 40 feet at the top and it's a concrete arches. So I'm not sure if Greg told you, but the installation of the steel beams in there was quite a thing because we couldn't rig from the concrete arches. Right. So we had to install steel. But rather than installing one of those big steel frame trusses that they do in some other, like in the other church circus schools that I've seen in definitely in England and also I think in Quebec City, they have just a big frame truss. And we didn't want to do that. We wanted to keep the elegance of the architecture as much as possible. So we installed steel beams into the concrete arches.
And they're always hidden
because of the paint. And then they painted them.
Right, they blend in. So it's left for a very beautiful space that we're just excited to see what we can do with. We had our first performance here this past weekend and it was awesome. it's a lot. We've had so many adventures already in this new space. I'm not sure if you saw the scissor lift inside the sanctuary.
We did.
Well, so we have two scissor lifts, one on each floor. We had to purchase scissor lifts because we use them all the time for the rigging. And this one is gigantic because it has to go up to 35 feet or something. So it's really big, but it's a good lift. It works well. When we started driving it, it was cracking the floorboards because it's so heavy and the floors were never made to withstand that kind of weight. So that was crazy. And so then we had to find a way to we have to lay plywood out on the floors every time we want to drive the lift now. So you can't just drive it around the room. You have to like lay plywood down to drive it.
Has the city been very supportive of you guys doing this, or has it been a challenge trying to get like all the circus permits and all the various things it takes to convert a church into a circus school?
Well, the city has been great. We should talk at some point about the state of Pennsylvania and the Board of Education, because that's a whole different story. But the city of Philadelphia has been very welcoming to us. We have a really good relationship with our local councilwoman. And I'm also just so much enjoying the way the other arts institutions are welcoming us. And this is part of that. We didn't talk too much about the nonprofit change, but forming a nonprofit feels to me like it has opened doors into this arts community that we were never part of before. And now we're like part of the club and we work with all the theaters and the dance companies and the museums. We go to all the same events and they come out here. It's been a really nice.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. What was it like forming like a board and the directors initially, like trying to find a group of people who would support it from a higher level?
Well, that was interesting. I would say finding the people, the initial group people, was not hard. We've had such a big community already of people that like the circus school that finding people wasn't that difficult. But the big leap for me was going from being a sole proprietor of a business where you can just kind of make decisions on the fly to being a nonprofit where not only must you stop and slow down and ask people, but you need to learn to rely on other people. I'm still working my way into it where I can say, okay, if we're having a financial problem, it's not all my responsibility to fix. Right. Yeah. And I can't just throw fix it in some patchwork way of my own. Like I have to actually turn to the board and say, what's the appropriate way to handle this? So it's been a learning curve for me, but overall the pros far outweigh the cons. I'm very excited to have, and now we have both. So I'm able to work in the nonprofit world. Most of my time is spent there now, but we do still have PSCA, which runs as a business. Mm-hmm. And so if there are things that fit better into a business model, they still can happen over there.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, our company is an LLC, but then my whole background is not for profit.
Sure.
And switching from a not for profit to an LLC felt freeing for me because I was like, oh my God, there's not like, I don't have to ask all these like donor letters and, you know, it's just like a whole crazy world. But I can totally understand how going to a not for profit, especially as a school, is actually probably an amazing community of people.
I was surprised at how when I ran my other circus school for so long, just no one from the arts world in Philadelphia ever wanted to talk to us.
Right.
You know, they thought of us as like a yoga studio or a gymnastics school. They just did not think of us as an arts institution at all. Even though what we're doing is not that different now than we ever were. We're still teaching circus. That's what we do. You know, but being a nonprofit, it's sort of like sends a message to the world that we're doing something it's not about the bottom line. That's about transforming an art form. And that's exciting to people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I've read a lot recently about how a lot of people who are circus writers or journalists are saying that circus in America is in a state of flux as Ringling is closed and Big Apple is reforming. What would you say is sort of the state of circus, particularly as it's focused towards education in the States? What do you see is happening now and where do you think it's going?
Sure. Good question. I can't tell you how many people have asked me over the last 6 months, like, so I hear circus is dead. How's that going to affect your school? You know? And of course, you guys know it. That's a frustrating question. But the answer I usually give, the simple answer, is that I feel like we're in this time of tremendous opportunity.
Yes.
That in fact, the closing of Ringling allows us to tell the story of what else circus is in a way that we couldn't very easily before. But it's going to be a little bumpy, I think, in the beginning of making that transition. I still find that I get a lot of people, there are a lot of people that just don't understand that there's anything more than Ringling Brothers. So it's going to be an uphill battle for us to tell that story and get that word out. And the only way we're going to do it is by having more shows touring the States so people can see other kinds of circus.
Right.
But I am optimistic. I think with us kind of entering the higher education model and with the National Endowment of the Arts and the Smithsonian starting to take us more seriously, it just feels like the doors are starting to open more and more towards circus as an art form in the US. Mm-hmm. And hopefully sending graduates out into the world will make a big difference in that way as well.
I know. I think it feels like a two prong thing. It's amazing how there's more circus programs, education programs coming up, like you guys in Circus Maine and NECA. Mm-hmm. And then also simultaneously, there needs to be more performing opportunities in the US. So then all these artists who are getting trained can stay.
Having said that, one of the things that we talked about with Lauren Eisling, this Australian producer, was how she thinks that circuses in Australia have a wide audience because some people do it as a kid or as a teenager and then become patrons of the art, even if they're not circus performers themselves. So just by virtue of having more places that teach circus to kids, they'll end up being bigger audiences for it.
Yeah, I think I heard that interview, and I think that's fascinating. I think we definitely could see something like that. There was something that came out a number of years ago, some statistic where people said that children in America are more likely to experience circus in a class than by seeing a circus show, which may be true. There certainly are a ton of circus education programs for kids around the country. And so if that happens, then yes, you'll have this audience that can at least relate to the skills a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good starting point for it, I think.
So when do auditions open up for next year's class?
So the applications are already online. We have applications online and they close December 31st.
All right. So
get them in quick.
You're about to apply.
Yes. If you want to apply for Circadium, now is the time.
What's the application process?
It's a pretty simple online application. You have to fill out your basic details and write a little artist statement about why you're doing this and submit a video. Mm-hmm. And the video is, I want to say it's maximum 3 minutes with a combination of physical skills and performance skills. And then if you're invited to auditions, you come to Philadelphia in March. We actually did a great job this year. I'm so proud with NECA and ECQ and ENC. We communicate about our audition schedules. So they're all, none of them conflict.
Oh, that's,
they're
all, that's great.
They're not quite in a row. Like you can't really easily go just one to the next, but they're at least all not conflicting. So the goal is to eventually get them all in a nice little lineup so people can do them all at once if they want to.
Or eventually maybe do it all in one place.
Yeah, that could be well too.
That'll never happen.
Yeah. Well, we talked about it a little bit because that's theater schools do that, right?
Yeah,
theater schools
they have. I went to theater school.
I mean, Cirque did it with Elwaz and Seven Fingers.
But it's great because you just prepare your thing and they're all.
But surely
there.
You want to like be able to pull the students aside and see if they have the identity that fits with like your school and in your environment.
I'm sure there's some way to do that. But I guess the reason I'm not going there right now is because especially being so new, I think it's really important for people to come here and see this place. They need to see the school. They need to meet us and kind of see how we work. And so we're really encouraging people that are interested even before or after auditions, like come here to Philly and just check us out. Like come for a visit. I have students coming for visits already who are just coming to kind of explore the place and see what they think before they apply. So we are encouraging people to do that.
Well, if
also.
I was a student and today was my day to come see this school, I'd be like, I'm applying.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to mention is that people ask me this all the time about the diploma that we get at Circadium. So I want to just explain that so it's clear. The diploma that Circadium offers it's called Diploma of Circus Arts, recognized by the Pennsylvania Board of Education. It's a vocational diploma. So it's like, there's not a real exact comparison, but it is similar to what you get from ENC, is it's vocational. It's not accredited. So that means you cannot take those credits and go to a graduate program, or you also can't get federal financial aid as it's not accredited. We may pursue accreditation later, but right now the reason that we're not doing that is because we would have to partner with the university and the tuition costs would just skyrocket if we did that. It would also require us to like really box our program into a university model, which we don't think would be appropriate right now. So our feeling right now is that it's better for the students to have a reasonable tuition price so they're not leaving with a ton of student debt rather than have that accredited degree and leave with $100,000 in debt.
I'm not particularly sure what the benefit of having like an accredited degree is in circus. I mean, I get why somebody's parents might want them to have an accredited degree, but it doesn't necessarily help you get a circus job more or less. And if you want to go into finance after you're done with this, somebody seeing I have an accredited degree in juggling is not necessarily going to be applicable.
Exactly. And that's the message I've been trying to get across to a lot of the nervous parents as well, because yeah, if your student wants to be a performing artist, what they need is they need 3 years with great coaches in a great space and hopefully some kind of recognition for doing that afterwards. But they don't need a bachelor's degree. And yeah, if they want to change careers, they're going to have to go back to school anyway.
Right.
So to me, one of the highest priorities for students who are entering a circus college should be to not sink into a ton of debt. Because when you leave, you don't want to be so saddled with debt that you can't be flexible in your career choices. Mm-hmm. So that's important, so that the finances are important, and also just knowing what you're getting into and knowing the difference between a diploma and a degree and, you know, an MFA. These are all options that are out there. You can get a doctorate in circus in Scandinavia and also in England.
We got an MFA. Doesn't
Circumedia now offers
Circumedia now is a master's in circus directing, which is so awesome.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Yes, it's really great.
We got our master's in theater producing.
Yeah.
Hey, that's good.
And management. Yeah.
But I was pretty convinced before I did. I was, my parents and my old boss talked me into it, but I was like, why on earth would I go and get a master's degree to pursue working in circus? That makes literally no sense to me. Mm-hmm. And my old boss was like, well, if you want to raise money from other people, having a master's degree helps in raising money. And I was like, oh, I guess it does. That's logical.
And connections help, certainly. Yeah. The connections you make in school help. But really, it's the time.
But you're getting some connections through you guys, too. You know,
Exactly. Connections help. But really, I just think for an artist, it's the time you spend that is the most valuable thing.
Yes.
So
the ability to focus for 3 years as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, your program sounds amazing. I wish I was 18.
Can't wait to see how it grows.
Please invite us to your end of your shows. It's going to be exciting. We have lots to do.
So I think we've reached the time for our final three questions.
Yeah.
Okay.
The first one of which is, have you received a piece of advice, really good or really bad, at some point in your life that has stuck with you?
Yes. And I'm trying to think what the best exact phrasing for it is. It's something, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's something about that invention is really all about hard work. That all the most brilliant things that happen in life are not because the idea just dawned on somebody. It's not about ideas. It's about putting in the sweat equity to make it happen. And I've heard that from a number of people over the years, but especially my husband, Greg, who fully believes that great creations are all about the work you put into it and not the brilliant idea. Yeah. So that's a good piece of advice.
I totally agree with that.
Yeah,
that's lovely.
Yeah.
So the second question is, and this is probably perfect for you, for somebody who is a student or wants to be a student of circus, is there a book or a movie or a show or just a thing you suggest that they read, watch, or see?
There are a couple of things. I mean, in general, I recommend that people read and watch and see as much as they possibly can. I'm a big reader and I read lots of fiction. And I think it provides just kind of a mental outlet for some of your you need to have breaks from your work as well. And I think fiction reading to me is like the best way to take a break. But these days I'm also reading a lot of circus history. I mentioned Duncan Wall earlier, and The Ordinary Acrobat is a great book that everyone should read.
In particular, if you're not sure where.
Exactly. It makes so many good connections between circus past and present and future. So I highly recommend that. And then the shows that are out right now, there are just so many. I see shows all the time. One of my particular favorites last year was La Verita by Compagnie Finzi Pasca.
Oh, yeah.
Such great work.
But does that play in Philadelphia somewhere?
It was in Philadelphia last year.
Yeah, it was at BAM. I don't know. Finzi Pasca has played at BAM. I don't know if that one was there.
It was a fantastic show. Fantastic show. And there's just so much good work coming out of some of the companies like Water on Mars and Gandini Juggling Project and Machine de Cirque and pretty much anything it's great to see. Racehorse Company, so many great companies that I love. I go see every show I can. We're looking forward to having a circus library here as we build up the school.
Yeah.
And I know at ENC they have a wonderful library where you can read all the books and also see videos of acts that have come before. But I'm having such fun teaching this class where I get to dig into all these old videos. Yesterday we were watching our Chaos.
Oh,
videos.
Yeah.
Which is just mind blowing. If you haven't watched our Chaos, go look them up on YouTube because you need to know that happened. That was quite an amazing time of life.
Yeah, I somebody's got the Lincoln Center has a theater theater on film and tape archive, where it's just tons of Broadway and off Broadway productions in a library. Well, I gotta sit at a TV and like find the one you want and hit play. Hopefully you guys can find some way to fund that. But if you get a video archive, just go and watch all the best circus ever.
Definitely. And the one that's coming up is, well, the movie is The Great Showman. Is that The Greatest Showman?
The Barnum one.
Yeah. So we were just watching the trailer for that in class because we're all very interested. We did a big theme on sideshow work and talking about whether that's good or bad or how people were treated in those days in like Barnum's era, you know? And so we're very interested to see how they portray the freak show element.
Yes, we have a few friends in the movie,
actually.
It looks
very polished. Yeah. It's interesting to see how like Hollywood views circus, you know?
They filmed it like right down the street from our apartment.
Did they? Really?
Yeah, and Olga Karmansky, who is one of our performers, who was in Slumber, she's in the movie.
Okay,
great. And a dancer, too.
Now keep your eyes peeled.
Yeah, so we're looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too. What's her name, Zendaya? The actress?
Oh, yeah, I think I saw her in the trailer.
She's like, I think she's like on a trapeze, and I was like, okay, can't wait to see. I'm excited for it.
Yep.
And our final question is, who do you think we should have on our podcast?
Who have you not had yet? You've had a lot of great people on your podcast.
I'm going to get Greg on.
You should get Greg on the podcast.
Yeah, he was showing us he was like, do you guys know what cigar boxes is? I was like, if I didn't know what cigar boxes, I'd be like, I need to go re-educate myself. But then he pulled out these things that he made. I was like, I've never seen that. It's so cool.
Greg's stuff is so visual. It might be hard to have him on the podcast, but
definitely. Do like a video podcast version.
It'd be easy for me to pick out, you know, all of my faculty because I think they're all brilliant and wonderful. I mean, Aidan O'Shea doesn't get nearly enough attention and recognition. Ben Grinberg, the director of Almanac Dance Circus Theater, is fantastic. So these are all good Philadelphia people. But I would also really encourage you to get some voices from other countries, like the directors of ENC, Eric Langlois, and Tim Roberts from Quebec. Tim Roberts is who you really need on this podcast. Okay. Tim is the most brilliant circus guy around. He was the director of FedEC for the longest time and worked at the National Center for Circus Arts for many years. And now he's over being the director of higher education at ECQ.
Great.
And we need to do our annual trip to
Montreal
and Quebec.
Yep.
Cool.
Well, Shannon, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yes,
it's a pleasure.
Thanks for coming.
Congratulations on the space. I really recommend people come and check it out.
Yeah, come and see it. Yeah, definitely. Great to talk to you guys.
Thanks.
That was our interview with Shayna Kennedy.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
You nailed that, like, in one take.
I really did. Have a good week, guys.
Bye.